Not enough to save it, he destroys it. Right, he did that in the flood. He does it in our lesson tonight. And the men rose up. Now this is after that they had promised Sarah that within a certain time she would bear a child. And the men rose up from thence and looked towards Sodom. That would be looking toward the east. From up on the plateau, wherever they were looking down, it would be in the valley, some 1,292 feet below sea level, something like that. And Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. And Jehovah said, now this seems to be a soliloquy. Jehovah speaking out loud. Now it's for Abraham's benefit, I think. Yes, that's true. But it seems that he just, as we would say, a soliloquy, where he's speaking out loud. Now he says, shall I hide from Abraham that which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth and all shall be blessed in him. That goes back, you see, to chapter 12 and verse 3, that in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed, or nations be blessed. For I have known him to the end that he may command his children and his household after him, that they may keep the way of Jehovah to do righteousness and justice, to the end that Jehovah may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. Now, he doesn't seem to be addressing Abraham or the other two with him or anybody, just as we would say, a soliloquy, which is speaking out loud. One is thinking out loud to himself. Right? And Jehovah said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous. Now notice that expression, that's great, it's very grievous. I will go down now, that is down from where he was here, down to the plain below, because he's there with Abraham now, and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know. I don't think that that means that God doesn't know what's going on down there. It just simply means that before God destroys a thing, he's going to have all the evidence necessary. He's going to, in other words, it'll be a just judgment. That's the point, I think, that's involved in this statement of the Lord, that my judgment may be a just and righteous judgment. And the men turned from thence and went towards Sodom. But Abraham stood yet before Jehovah. Now, one of these angels is the special representation of Jehovah. I do not believe that it was Jehovah himself, because no man has seen God at any time. We are told that a number of times in the New Testament. John, the first chapter. 1 Timothy 6. And so on. So no man has seen God. This is the angel of Jehovah, or the representation, the representative of Jehovah. It seems to me you have to conclude that. And Abraham drew near and said, wilt thou consume the righteous with the wicked? Now, when he said, I'm going down to see what's going on, Abraham apparently knows the condition of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. And though God hadn't said, I'm going to go judge them, yet Abraham deduces this conclusion, that that's what he's going to do. Now he said, will you destroy or consume the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure there are 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou consume and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are therein? That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, that so the righteous should be as the wicked. That be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Now, Abraham is very cautious in this. He's not belligerent. He's not uppity or arrogant or anything like that. It's a very humble thing that he's doing here. And seemingly he hesitates to say what he is saying here. But I want you to note this expression. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Now, Jehovah was no tribal deity. He was the judge of all the earth. He still is. The God that judges. So here he's the judge of all the earth, as recognized by Abraham. And Jehovah said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sake. Now, probably since you're going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, in fact, there were five cities of the plain. We'll mention all five of them in a few moments. Maybe he meant in all of them. Would he destroy the whole thing, spare all of them for 50 righteous persons? And God said, yes, I will spare all the place for their sake. Now, this is the thing we want to note, that there were only 8 righteous saved in the ark when God destroyed the world with a flood. There were not 10 righteous persons in Sodom and Gomorrah. Later on, when God raised up his prophets and sent them into Israel, they could not find enough righteous people to spare Israel. 135 years later, when God raised up Micah and Isaiah, no, that was later than that. 135 when he raised Jeremiah. Jeremiah, and of course Ezekiel was over in Babylon, and there was Habakkuk also, and Nahum, these four prophets beside Huldah the prophetess. But God still could not find enough righteous to cause him to spare the city. Now this is the thing, that a lesson I want to impress. That we wonder sometimes how, when you read of the wickedness and corruption of this nation, how does God refrain from destroying it? I think the answer is, there is still enough salt to preserve it. Jesus said, ye are the salt of the earth, to his disciples. But if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? Thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden underfoot of men. You're the light of the world. Now, as long as there is sufficient salt, God will spare this nation. Now, when it'll be destroyed, it'll be when the salt is gone. Now, you see the responsibility that that puts on us? When I think about that, then what depends on me, what depends on you here, is to be the salt of the present generation. And Abraham answered and said, behold now, I've taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, who am but dust and ashes. He began with from the dust of the earth, and we eventually return to ashes, as it were. Peradventure, there shall lack 5 of the 50 righteous. Wilt thou destroy all the city for lack of 5? And he said, I will not destroy it if I find the 45. And he said unto him yet again, and said, peradventure, there shall be 40 found there. And he said, I will not do it for the 40's sake. And he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Peradventure, there shall 30 be found there. And he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, behold now. You notice he just gets a little more tense and a little more humble here and a little more cautious each time that he speaks. And he said, behold now, I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord. Peradventure there shall be 20 found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for the 20's sake. And he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak yet but this once. Peradventure 10 shall be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for the 10's sake. Now, he couldn't go any farther than that. If he had, it would look selfish, wouldn't look like all he's asking for is just Lot and his family. So Abraham left off, and Jehovah went his way as soon as he had left off communing with Abraham, and Abraham returned unto his place. All right, now that bears out the thing I said a while ago about the destruction at the time of Noah, this destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and later on I forgot the 15th chapter here. And in the 15th chapter here, when he says that the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. Right, that's another that fits in there. And so he could not destroy the people of the land and give that land unto Abraham until the iniquity of the Amorites was full. So really we have 3 here. We have the flood. Then we have the iniquity of the Amorites. And then we have Sodom and Gomorrah. All right? Now, 8 was not enough. That's all that would enter the ark. So no use to fool with it anymore. We destroy it. The iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. Genesis 15, verse about 14 to 16. Right near Sodom and Gomorrah, if I can find 10 people, I'll spare it. So he couldn't destroy the Amorites and give that land to Abraham until the iniquity, the cup of their iniquity was full. Right? Remember that. Good lesson to learn. If you don't remember, if you don't learn anything else tonight than that, that'll be worth living. That points out the great responsibility of the church to convert people to the Lord and to live as the salt of the earth themselves. Let's not lose sight of that. Chapter 19, right, now comes the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the two angels came to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. And Lot saw them and rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. Right, now the two angels, know what they're called? Angels. Jehovah, the one that represented Jehovah, his representative, stayed and talked to Abraham. While they were talking to Abraham, these two went on into the city. Now the third, Jehovah, apparently returned to his throne or wherever it might have come from to Abraham. Right, now notice where Lot is. Now back in the 14th chapter, or the 13th chapter, Lot pitched his tent towards Sodom. Now he's come to dwell in Sodom. He's sitting at the gate. That means a place here of where one judges or looked upon as one of the elders of the city. Later on, the people of Sodom charge him with being a judge in their midst. Now this says something to me. It says that Lot, when he came into the city, he seemingly began to compromise with these people, and here he was sitting in the gate as one of the elders of the city. Sodom was getting into him, although I want to look at that in a few moments. Peter calls him the righteous Lot. Not on only one ground on which I think he could do that, and I'll try to think about that when I get to the proper passage here. Right, and these two came on to Sodom and sat in the gate of Sodom where Lot did. And Lot saw them and rose up to meet them. And he bowed himself with his face to the earth. Now he shows here a very hospitable spirit, characteristic of the people of the east. But I wonder if in these men he saw them as strangers and they didn't look as though they were wicked as the people of Sodom. And he would spare them for what he knew they would face in the city of Sodom. So he bows himself and he said, "Behold now, my lords." Now that doesn't mean that he recognized me deity. That's just, we would say, "Sirs, my sirs, turn aside, I pray you, into your servant's house, and tarry all night and wash your feet, and you shall rise up early and go on your way." And I said, "Nay, but we will abide in the street all night." And he urged them greatly. Now they are evidently there. Is his invitation genuine or is it not? They said, "No, we'll decline it." But he urged them greatly, and they turned in unto him and entered into his house, and he made them a feast and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. Probably he might have slain one of the animals also. I don't know to what extent he made this feast, but at any rate, it was more than just giving them bread and wine, something like that. Now, but before they lay down, now here's where you come to the real wickedness of Sodom. Sodomy here on the part of these individuals. But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, "Where are the men that came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them." The word there is intercourse. That we may have a homosexual relation with them. This is the thing that they're talking about here. Now here's where here's the sin of Sodom. It's rather the wicked people, but this is a special expression of it. Bring them out that we may have this homosexual relation with them or intercourse with them. And Lot went out unto them, out unto them to the door and shut the door after him. That manifested bravery and courage on his part. He is weak in some ways, as you're going to see. I think a very weak man spiritually, but apparently a man of physical courage, for he at least shut the door so they couldn't get in. Apparently the door had to be opened from within. And he shut that door and stood out and faced these men. And he said, I pray you, my brethren. Now, that struck me as rather strange. My brethren. Now, he is sitting at the gate. Now, he addresses them as his brethren. Maybe he meant my fellow citizens. I don't know what he meant. But at any rate, this is what he called them. Does that indicate a degree of compromise that he had reached with these people? Not with their sin, because he abhors that, as you see, and that to me is the only expression of his righteousness in the whole matter. Do not do so wickedly. Behold now, I have two daughters that have not known man. They're virgins. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for as much as they are come under the shadow of my roof. That's a very strong expression of the Oriental hospitality of that time. But you cannot admire Lot at all for offering his daughters unto these men, knowing what the result would be. But now you see the extreme wickedness of these people in that they prefer two men to two women in which to vent their lust. All right? And they said, stand back. And they said, this one fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs be a judge, which indicates that apparently he had been censoring what they had done as he sat in the gate. No doubt censored what they had done, and they don't like that. Right, and so he comes in, and he would be a judge over us. Now will we deal worse with thee than with them? And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and drew near to break the door. But the men put forth their hand, and notice he's called angels back here in verse 1, called men here, same thing a little later. The men put forth their hand and brought Lot into the house to them and shut to the door. Now here's where they exercise a miraculous power here. And they smote the men that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves to find the door. Here they're fumbling around in the dark. They can't see, can't find the door here. All right, now I don't know whether Lot knew that they were blind yet or not, or whether these men were angels or what they were. Don't know about that. And the men said unto Lot, hast thou here any besides son-in-law and thy sons and thy daughters, and whomsoever thou hast in the city? Bring them out of the place, for we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxed great before Jehovah, and Jehovah has sent us to destroy it. Maybe that's the first time that he realized, and I'm sure it is, unless he knew that they'd smitten those men with blindness. This would be the first time that he realizes he's entertained angels unaware. And you remember that Abraham had done it, and so did Lot now. And we're told in Hebrews, what is 13:1, show hospitality, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Right, Abraham had, so did Lot here. So now he goes back. For we will destroy this place here. For we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxed great before Jehovah. And Jehovah has sent us to destroy it. I read that. And Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, who married, or either were to marry or had married, his daughters. If they were the ones that were to marry these two daughters, then these are the only two daughters he has. If they're sons-in-law who have already married his daughters, then he has daughters in the city besides these two. Now, I personally think that they're already married to them. That they are his sons-in-law who have already married daughters of Lot, so that he has other daughters in the city, maybe grandchildren, for what we know. And he said, up, get you out of this place, for Jehovah will destroy the city. But he seemed unto his sons-in-law as one that mocked. Why? Does that indicate what they had seen in Lot? That they hadn't seen, that they had seen a compromising spirit in him? To where what he said appeared to them as one that mocked? Or is it because of their own wickedness? And apparently it is. They ought not to have been in that crowd if they were any good, if they had wives. Had no business being in that crowd, but at any rate they were. And when the morning arose, they seemed as one that mocked. When the morning arose, then the angels, now notice here they're called angels, hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters that are here. Now when he said that are here indicates that he has others, doesn't it? So I'm persuaded that he had daughters married to these men already, not in prospect, but already. But that are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of this city. But he lingered, and the men, now notice in verse 15, the angels, here in verse 16, the men, they are angels. They are angels in the appearance of men. It appeared as men. So either expression is correct. We've had that back earlier, back in verse 1, the two angels. Then a little bit later back here we just read, these men here. Now you have a men and angels again, used interchangeably. So they're appearing as men, but in reality are angels from the Lord. Now here's what the men had to do. And the men arise and get out here. But he lingered. Now that doesn't speak very well for him. He lingered, and the men laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, Jehovah being merciful unto him. Now, here you find, see the word God and the word Jehovah used one time, another. Why? I think there's always a reason for that. That when he uses the word God, he is speaking of the powerful one or the creative one. The one who creates, the one who exercises power. When he used the word Jehovah, it's the merciful one. The one that shows mercy. It's the same God, don't misunderstand me. But it's the God of power or the God of mercy and compassion. Well, you will notice here, he used the word Jehovah. All right, so here, he lingered there and laid the hands upon them here and came to pass. And it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad. Oh no, back up further. The hand of his two daughters, Jehovah being merciful unto them. And they brought him forth and set him without the city. Now notice he still doesn't stop arguing with these men. He's reluctant to leave. I think he must have had daughters, grandson, children there in the city. Don't know whether any sons or not, they never mentioned. And it came to pass when they had come, he brought them forth abroad, that he said, escape for thy life. That is one of the angels did. Now notice the four things he says do. First, escape for thy life. Second, look not behind thee. Third, neither stay thou in all the plain. Fourth, escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. Here are four urgent exhortations here. Hortations to them, if you want to call it that. Right? Escape. Look not behind. Neither stay in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be consumed. Now, notice Lot argues with that. Seems to me that if two angels told me that God was going to destroy a city, and he showed me the mercy to get out, I'd do something about it. But same way today. God said, I'm going to destroy the world. Escape from it, flee the wrath of God. But people want to argue with that. They want God to change that a little. And Lot said unto them, Oh, not so, my Lord. Behold, now thy servant hath found favor in thy sight, and hast magnified thy loving kindness, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest evil overtake me and I die. That's mighty small faith, isn't it? If God says you go to the mountain in order to be saved, that's where a fellow ought to head for, isn't it? Why stop and argue with it? I like this. I might probably use this, said this a good many times. I heard Brother Biles, a black preacher, one-armed preacher, good many, many years ago, nearly 50, I guess now, preaching. And he's preaching on faith. He's my brothers and sisters. He said that faith is doing what God said to do. Not arguing with him. Now, if God told me to jump through that brick wall, it would be mine to start jumping. It would be the Lord's to open up a way. I think that well expressed it. If God said you flee to the mountains, I'm not going to argue about what's going to happen before I get there. God said you find refuge in Jesus Christ on your road to heaven. That's where you're going to find it. All right? And it's mine to jump. It's mine to head for the mountains. But he said, lest evil overtake me and I die. Behold, now, this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. And he said unto him, since, see, I have accepted thee concerning this thing also, that I will not overthrow the city of which thou hast spoken. That shows he was going to overthrow it because he overthrew two others. I'll have to look those names up in a moment. Which thou hast spoken. Haste thee, escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou be come hither. Evidently had that word from Jehovah God, unto him an angel. Don't do anything until Lot has escaped. Therefore the name of the city was called Zoar, that is little, a small one. All right, now there are two others besides Sodom and Gomorrah, Zeboam and I forget the other, we'll mention them later. All right, now so here the Lot now is fleeing for Zoar, just a small village close by. The sun was risen upon the earth. Now here's a dreadful scene. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot came unto Zoar. Then Jehovah rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from Jehovah out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. I don't think I've ever read that. At least I know I haven't for 50 years, since I became acquainted with it some 50, 54 years ago, earlier in my early Bible study. I think I never read that, but I have a sympathetic feeling for Mrs. Lot. Now, she had daughters, maybe grandchildren in the city, in Sodom. Also a home with that. Maybe she was a member of the garden club. And she had a lot of friends there. And social friends. She had a lot of things there. And so the record says she looked back from behind. That indicates she was lagging behind. And she paused and looked back with a last look and became a pillar of salt. Now whether instantaneously or whether she fell down dead and salt encrusted the body later, she just became a pillar of salt is all. But remember this. When a person starts out and turns or looks back, becomes a pillar of salt, he's just as dead as if he'd stayed in Sodom and become a pile of ashes. What's the difference? Both of them are just as dead. One's as dead as the other. So here's a fellow that stays in Sodom and he perishes with the world. There's a fellow that starts out and he looks longly back, which God told him not to do. He that puts his hand to the plow and looks back, not fit for the kingdom of God. And he looks back, while he becomes a pillar of salt, he doesn't bear as if he stayed in the city. You know, this is the only woman that God ever said, remember? In Luke, remember Lot's wife. The only woman that God ever said, remember. And I think pretty good idea to remember. She looked, remember for what? She looked back, became a pillar of salt. But whatever it was that might have appealed to her and drawn her heart back, God says, don't look back. And God says that, well, that's what he means. All right, and so she looked back and became a pillar of salt. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he had stood before Jehovah. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain. And beheld, and lo, the smoke of the land went up as the smoke of a furnace. Now, just how the fire and brimstone came down It doesn't matter. We don't ask the question because no, we have no answer. But the fact that it was all going up as a pillar of, out of a furnace indicates, and they think that there's gas, the bitumen pits were there, and that's related to petroleum, as you know. And maybe there was escaping gases or petroleum out of the earth or something, and this fire set all that on fire. I don't know. But at any rate, it was going up as the smoke of the furnace the next morning. You remember here as the Sea of Galilee comes down and comes around something like this, and here comes over. Now up here was a, what we call the tongue, comes in something like this. And this part down here, now this part down here is very shallow. There are places here where you can actually wade across it, just 3 or 4 feet deep. It's not over 12 feet, any of this. Now, this leads people to believe that Sodom and Gomorrah were located here in the southern end of the Dead Sea, and that after this was over, that evidently part of this land sank or something happened to it, burned out or something here by this intense heat. But at any rate, very shallow here. I don't know whether they've ever gone under the water there to see if they can locate anything or not. I read years ago in some book, but a lot of things like this I don't ever use as fact because it hadn't been verified. But I read somewhere where an individual, where they had seen, it looked like the remains of ruins of buildings down under there. Well, if they had, somebody would have investigated by now, so I've never read more about it, so I don't put my stock in that. But I also read this, knowing how shallow this is, and even it's filling up now from what it was back in the days of the Roman Empire. But there's a Roman road that comes to there and then comes out over here. A Roman road here goes on, indicating that it's a little deeper now than it was 1900 years ago. Hard enough from the air, you can see the ruins of that old road as it comes up there. Now you can see that. Now I want you to note verse 29. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. All right, now here's another lesson. Here now is destruction when there's not enough salt. All right, now here's another lesson that we'll learn, and that is the power of a prayer, the prayer of a righteous man. Baileth much in its working, we are told that James tells us. Right here, the prayer of Abraham, by which Lot was saved. Lot was saved by that prayer. Paul said in 1 Timothy 2, 1-3, I exhort therefore, first of all, the supplications, prayers, intercessions, thanksgivings, be made for all men, for kings, and for them that are in high place, that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and gravity. Who knows what the power of the prayers of the saints for our rulers, what it might accomplish so far as providing for us a tranquil and quiet life of godliness in which to preach and teach the word of God. They go on to say that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and gratitude. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who will have all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. How are men going to be saved? By the truth. How are they going to know the truth? By our preaching it and teaching it. So Paul's exhortation to pray for the rulers and the governors is to the end that we may lead the kind of a life that will permit us to continue to preach the word and to teach. Now when we cease to do that and the salt is gradually gone, then what do you have left? Only wickedness, destined to destruction. Yes, ma'am. 1 Timothy 2:1-5. Yes, ma'am. 1 Timothy 2:1-5. Right, and then there's that statement in Luke 18:1-8. Jesus spake a parable unto them to the end that men ought always to pray and not to faint, saying thou was in the city as a judge that feared not God and God not man, so on. Then he says here, how much more shall your heavenly Father avenge his elect to cry unto him day and night, yet he long-suffering toward all. Howbeit, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? When Christ comes, will he find enough faith on the part of his people that they are still praying? All right, now look at how all that fits in. Here the saints are praying. Right, they are praying for the rulers and so on, that we may lead the right life, that we might preach the gospel and all of that. This, you see, is what preserves the nation. Righteousness exalteth the nation. Sin is reproach unto any people. Proverbs, 14:34. Psalm 9:17, the wicked shall be turned back into Sheol, even all the nations that forget God. What is the first line of defense in the United States? It's not these atomic bombs. It's not our Navy. It's not the Air Force. It's not the Marines. It's not the Seabees. It's not the Green Berets. It's not those fellows. It's the saints. Righteousness. The saints constitute the first line of defense of a nation. I believe in a strong military defense. I believe all that because the nation stands by the sword. It was established by the sword, it exists by the sword, and will perish with the sword. But its first line of defense is the righteousness of the saints. Here then is the prayer of Abraham. And what it accomplished yet? We don't know. You say, well, I don't know whether God's going to hear a prayer or not. No, he won't hear it at all if that's the way you feel about it. If you don't think God's going to hear it, you will not pray. I believe God hears me every time I pray. He doesn't answer everything I ask for, but I believe that he hears me when I pray. I've got to pray in that faith. All right? So Abraham's prayer was that power by which Lot was saved. So hear the intercessory prayer when he prayed for him back yonder. Now, they'd be great lessons, aren't they? Go clear on back to that particular time. All right? Moving on. Oh, I intended up here in verse 25 when it said, and he overthrew those cities and all the plain. Now, look at Deuteronomy 29 and 23, where here he mentioned two other cities that were likewise destroyed. And 29:23, and that the whole land thereof is brimstone and salt, and the burning that is not sown, nor breath, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which Jehovah overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. Right, it were those two I was trying to think of a moment ago, were Admah and Zeboim, and then there was Zoar. Now, he destroyed four of the cities, but he spared Zoar because Lot fled there. But Lot doesn't stay there. Lot gets out of the city pretty quick himself. All right, now let's move on now. Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters with him. And he feared to dwell in Zoar, and he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. All right, he feared to stay there. Why? Apparently, those people didn't like him, didn't want him in their city. I don't know, they might have held him responsible for what had happened because of his attitude toward God. This I don't know. But at any rate, we move on here. And now here is one of the most revolting pictures in the book of Genesis. It's it and the 38th chapter, 37th chapter along there, when Judah and his relation there to his daughter-in-law, whom he thought was a harlot. There's some revolting things, and God doesn't cover them up. He presents things as they really are. Right? And the firstborn said unto the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of all the earth. Now that shows lack of faith there. God would have provided them a companion if they'd have needed. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. Well, Lot here shows a rather ugly disposition in getting drunk, or drinking here as he does. And they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay with her father. And he knew not when she lay down, nor when she arose. Evidently, he is quite intoxicated, but he's not completely out, apparently. And it came to pass on the morrow that the firstborn said unto the younger, Behold, I lay yesternight with my father. Let us make him drink wine this night also. And go thou in and lie with him, that we may preserve seed of our father. And I made thy father drink wine that night also. And the younger arose and lay with him, and he knew not when she lay down nor when she arose. Right? He'd gone into a stupor there. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. So these two nations are born of incest, Moab and Ammon. And the firstborn bare a son and called his name Moab. The same is the father of the Moabites unto this day. And the younger, she also bare a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. The same is the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. Right, so that the Moabites and the Ammonites, which I left my little map here, here you come down, and here is the Dead Sea here. A little further down here. All right, now here is the river Arnon here. Here is the river Zered. Moab was in between these two rivers. Edom, whom we come to later on, he was down south here, and Ammon was up here, about here. There was a line here. He was over there. There was another people in here. There was Sihon, the king of the Amorites, here, and Ammon and Moab. Right? And then, of course, the Jews came in here, and here was Israel over here. Right? So they're all right here, family right here, close together. Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Israelites, all in there quite close. All right, so here are two nations, the offspring of an incestuous relation of two daughters with their father. That's a sordid, revolting picture. So in this chapter, you have an outstanding, one of the outstanding, dreadful scenes here in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Then you have one of the revolting acts and conduct of two individuals. It shows the influence of Sodom on these people. Now, although it is said, and I should have mentioned that back yonder, move back to chapter 19 and verse 9. And they said, stand back. And they said, this one fellow came in to sojourn, and he will needs be a judge. Now will we deal with? Now, maybe that's what Peter had in mind when he speaks of righteous Lot. This has always been one of the most difficult passages for me to understand from the Apostle Peter over here. In 2 Peter, the second chapter here, when he speaks here of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, get it right, here it is. All right, and verse 6, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, having made them an example unto those that shall live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, so distressed by the lascivious life of the wicked. Now, this probably is the ground of Peter's statement, is the fact here that they said he'd come into Judges, and apparently he censored what they were doing. That is at least indicated. But you surely don't have a great deal of respect for Lot. How that he chose the plain country because it was well watered, pitched his tent toward Sodom, came to dwell in Sodom, and was sitting as a judge here at the gate, and then was reluctant to flee. And when he did, he didn't want to go where God wanted him to go. But he left there, and he wound up in a cave here with his two daughters. And Sodom had so infiltrated their life in thinking that they committed this terrible act of incest to their father, to bear children by him. And another thing, he was persuaded to get drunk there on the two different occasions. None of this impresses us with Lot. And there must have been something about him that enabled Peter to say that. And unless that's it in verse 9 there, I don't know what it could have been. Because that's about all of it. It doesn't impress me at all. I never have seen anything in Lot that I really admired. Have you? Maybe you can help me out. Maybe I'm prejudiced. Nobody else seems to be have much of a... Can you say anything good for him? I don't know anything good for him particularly either, except that he must have sensed, he must have stood up against them in some way, because they didn't like him there. Now chapter 20 right quickly. Now we're introduced here to the move of Abraham into the land of Gerar and his relation to Abimelech. Now this is a number of years later than his time down in Egypt. Some think about 20 years, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20, a long time. And Abraham journeyed from thence, that is from the Oak of Mamre. The last account we had of him here, here is the Oak of Mamre near Hebron. Now he journeys from there into the land of the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur, and his sojourn in Gerar. All right, well, that means then here was Jerusalem located about here, right, and here was Hebron down somewhere about here. Right, now he moves on down. Here's Beersheba over here. Passes by Beersheba and comes on down. Here's your coastal line here. And he comes on down into this area here, the land of the south, the Negev. Here was Kadesh, somewhere down about here. Here's Kadesh. And over here was Gerar up in here. So somewhere in this general area here is where he came here to sojourn. Now here's a man that we meet here, and I think we'll have to have a little admiration for him in some ways. That's Abimelech. And thence to dwell here in the land of the south. Now that's the Negev between Kadesh and Shur. Now Shur was this, as this comes on down here, comes on down here. Here was Shur, was this land here of the poets here. So somewhere between Kadesh here, up here, someplace, if not there, maybe a little bit lower, maybe about here. Somewhere between there, and he was down in that general area of land there, this particular time. Right? And Abraham said unto Sarah, his wife, and Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah, took her into his harem there, probably thinking that since Abraham had all these flocks and herds, he was a good man to make friends with. So he took her into his harem. But God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night.